Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-decision episode of SCOTUScast, Two Habeas Opinions, No Oral Arguments Edition. I'm your host, Bridget Flaherty. In June, the Supreme Court issued per curiam opinions in two habeas cases, Jenkins v. Hutton and Virginia v. LeBlanc. In today's episode, we will be discussing the opinions in both cases. Jenkins v. Hutton. More than 30 years ago, an Ohio jury convicted Percy Hutton of aggravated murder, attempted murder, and kidnapping. The jury findings included aggravating circumstances that permitted imposition of the death penalty or life imprisonment. During the penalty phase of the proceedings, the jury was instructed that it could recommend a death sentence only if it unanimously found that the state had proved beyond a reasonable doubt that the aggravating circumstances of which Hutton was found guilty outweighed the mitigating factors. The jury recommended death. The trial court accepted that recommendation, and Hutton's death sentence was affirmed on direct appeal. He eventually filed a habeas petition, arguing that the trial court denied him due process because it failed to tell the penalty phase jurors that, when weighing aggravating mitigating factors, they could consider only the two aggravating factors they had found during the guilt phase of the trial. As Hutton had not objected to the jury's instructions at trial or raised this issue on direct appeal, the district court dismissed his habeas petition on grounds of procedural default. A divided panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit reversed, however, concluding that it could excuse the procedural default in the interests of avoiding a miscarriage of justice. Hutton, the Sixth Circuit argued, had shown by clear and convincing evidence that, but for a constitutional error, no reasonable jury would have found him eligible for the death penalty under the applicable state law. In a per curiam opinion issued on June 19th, the Supreme Court reversed the judgment of the Sixth Circuit and remanded the case. The Sixth Circuit erred in reaching the merits of Hutton's claim, the court concluded, because to overcome a procedural default on fundamental miscarriage of justice grounds, the focus should be on whether a properly instructed jury could have recommended death, not simply whether an alleged error might have affected the jury's verdict. Now, Virginia v. LeBlanc. In 1999, Dennis LeBlanc, who was then 16, raped a 62-year-old woman and was sentenced to life imprisonment in 2003 by a Virginia court. Although Virginia had abolished parole, the state had replaced it with a geriatric release program for the conditional release of older inmates under some circumstances. In 2010, however, the U.S. Supreme Court held in Graham v. Florida that the Eighth Amendment prohibits juvenile offenders convicted of non-homicide offenses from being sentenced to life without parole. Although states would not be required to guarantee eventual freedom to non-homicide juvenile inmates, the court explained, they must still offer juvenile offenders some meaningful opportunity to obtain release based on demonstrated maturity and rehabilitation. Invoking the Graham decision, LeBlanc filed a motion in Virginia State Court to vacate his sentence. The state court denied relief, relying upon the Virginia Supreme Court's prior decision in Angel v. Commonwealth, which had concluded that Virginia's geriatric release program satisfied Graham's parole requirement for juvenile non-homicide offenders. The Virginia Supreme Court declined review of LeBlanc's case, and he then filed a federal habeas petition arguing that the Virginia court's position regarding geriatric release in Graham had fundamentally misapplied federal law. The district court agreed and granted relief. A divided U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit affirmed, and Virginia sought cert. In a per curiam opinion issued on June 12th, the Supreme Court reversed the judgment of the Fourth Circuit, concluding that the Virginia courts had not applied the Graham rule unreasonably. To satisfy the habeas standard, the Supreme Court noted, the ruling in question must be objectively unreasonable, not merely wrong. Even clear error will not suffice. And it was not objectively unreasonable, the court indicated, for the state courts to conclude that, because the geriatric release program employed normal parole factors, He had satisfied Graham's requirement that juveniles convicted of a non-homicide crime have a meaningful opportunity to receive parole. Justice Ginsburg filed a concurring opinion. And now, to discuss the cases, we have Ron Eisenberg, Deputy District Attorney for the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office.
Two more end-of-term, unanimous, summary reversals of federal appeals courts for abusing their limited power to review state criminal convictions. On June 12th, the Supreme Court overturned the Fourth Circuit in Virginia versus LeBlanc. A week later, the court reversed the Sixth Circuit in Jenkins versus Hutton. Since the federal habeas statute was amended in the late 1990s by the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, AEDPA for short, the Supreme Court has in similar fashion reversed literally dozens of circuit court opinions for failing to follow the law. It's probably the court's biggest block of cases over the last two decades. To understand the significance of these latest decisions, or maybe their insignificance, some background is necessary. LeBlanc was a Virginia teenaged rapist who was sentenced to life in prison. Some years later, the U.S. Supreme Court decided to ban life without parole for such juvenile criminals. There must be at least a possibility of eventual release. Virginia held that LeBlanc's sentence did not violate the new rule because Virginia has a geriatric release statute that functions like parole, allowing the possibility of release after turning 60. The Fourth Circuit said, not good enough. 60 is practically dead, and besides, release must be probable, not just remotely possible. And not only that, said the Fourth Circuit, this conclusion was obvious, so obvious that the Virginia courts were not just wrong, but practically nuts to have ruled otherwise. Meanwhile, in Ohio, Hutton, a convicted murderer, was challenging his death sentence. At his trial, the jury found two aggravating circumstances that made the case capital. The murder occurred in the course of a kidnapping, and the defendant shot and tried to kill two people, not just one. Proceeding directly to the penalty phase, the jury then determined that aggravating factors outweighed mitigating factors and voted for death. The Sixth Circuit said, not good at all. How do we know, ruled the court, that the aggravating factors the jurors weighed in the penalty phase were the same ones they had just found at the guilt phase? The trial judge should have explicitly instructed them to consider those two things and nothing else. And not only that, said the Sixth Circuit, this problem was obvious. So obvious that it didn't even matter that Hutton had never raised the claim in state court, thereby defaulting it. Because if we assume the jury considered the wrong aggravating factors, or maybe even didn't consider any, then it would be as if the defendant was innocent of the death penalty, as if he wasn't eligible for a capital sentence at all. Well, Virginia sought review from the Fourth Circuit decision, as did Ohio from the Sixth Circuit. Both states filed for certiorari in the United States Supreme Court, where the petitions would normally have gotten exactly nowhere. The court receives thousands of cert petitions. The vast majority are denied, without explanation, never to be heard from again. Or sometimes you get lucky. In rare cases, the court grants review, which entitles the parties to draft even longer briefs, go through the grueling argument preparation process, and then wait, possibly until summer, for a full opinion, usually accompanied by various concurring or dissenting opinions. But here, neither of those things happened. First, there was the Virginia per curiam, issued 2 weeks before the end of the term. The Fourth Circuit's conclusion about geriatric release was not, it turned out, obvious at all. On the contrary, said the Supreme Court, reasonable arguments could be made either way. Maybe age 60 was too long to wait. Maybe Virginia's system was too restrictive, but maybe not. The question need not be resolved because of AEDPA. Under the habeas statute, the state court doesn't have to guess right about how to apply Supreme Court precedent. It just has to have a reasonable view. If so, the lower federal courts must stand down, even if they have a different interpretation of the applicable law. 7 days later, it was the Sixth Circuit's turn to be summarily corrected. It is true, observed the Supreme Court, that a defendant who fails to preserve a claim in state court can sometimes get review in federal habeas court. There is an exception to the procedural default rule for actual innocence. The question is whether, in the absence of the alleged legal error, any reasonable jury would still have convicted the defendant. In capital cases, that question applies not just to the crime, but to the aggravating factors that make the defendant eligible for the death penalty. In the Ohio case, that shouldn't have been an issue at all. No one even questioned that Hutton actually committed the murder, that he did so in the course of a kidnapping, and that he attempted to kill a second victim as well. The only way to conclude that a reasonable jury should nonetheless have rejected a death sentence is to start out by assuming the rather implausible notion that during the short break between the guilt phase and the penalty phase, the jury might have changed its mind about the factors it had just found, if only the judge had invited it to do so. That kind of assumption, ruled the Supreme Court, is exactly the opposite of what the Sixth Circuit should have done. The exception to procedural default exists for only those defendants who can make a strong showing of innocence that is independent of their legal claim. Hutton, in contrast, could be considered innocent of the death penalty factors only by completely circular reasoning available to any court with adequate imagination. So, two new Supreme Court habeas opinions, both from out of nowhere without the usual advance notice provided by the certiorari process. No merits briefs, no oral argument, no author, just straight back to the sentences originally imposed. Now, the fact is that lots of appellate courts issue summary decisions, sometimes with short per curiam opinions. When other courts do that, though, it's because the case has to be decided, but it isn't really important enough to justify the bother of full briefing and a full opinion. In a court like the Supreme Court, however, it's just the opposite. Virtually no case has to be decided because the court has the discretion not to hear it at all. If it's not important, deny cert. Why these summary habeas reversals, then, and why so many year after year? Is the court hoping the message will finally be heard by the judges it supervises? Do the justices feel a special commitment to enforcing this one esoteric chapter of the United States Code? If so, they have demonstrated a persistence of purpose with unusual unanimity in the face of fairly modest results. It is not clear that compliance with AEDPA has significantly increased, at least in several of the circuits. Perhaps, though, there is one new element in these latest accretions to the court's AEDPA jurisprudence. Both Jenkins v. Hutton and Virginia v. LeBlanc are quite short, 5 and 7 pages, respectively. The added length of the Virginia case comes in part from an extra section tacked on at the end of the opinion. It wasn't strictly necessary. The court's legal analysis is complete without it. This section adopts the state's argument that the Fourth Circuit ruling was a particular affront to federalism because it created a conflict with the Virginia Supreme Court's ruling that would affect a large class of cases. State judges would be required to follow their state court and uphold sentences like LeBlanc's, while federal judges would be required to follow the Fourth Circuit and reverse those same sentences. As it happens, that dilemma is not particularly rare. It arises every time a federal circuit court issues a habeas decision addressing a general rule of state practice. A state Supreme Court, for example, holds that compliance with a state procedural provision is mandatory. A federal habeas court then declares that the provision is constitutionally inadequate and therefore unenforceable. A state court holds that co-defendants should generally be tried together and that any confessions must be redacted with neutral pronouns. A federal court then strikes down every one of those convictions on the ground that such redactions are insufficient. In practice, participants in state criminal proceedings serve two masters, masters who often take not just different but directly conflicting views on the meaning of the one constitution they all must follow. AEDPA was supposed to moderate those tensions. Will the per curiam decision in LeBlanc make a difference? Maybe, but past performance suggests that further intervention may be needed.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. SCOTUS Cast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers. founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.